I found such common cause with the work of joining together with people of different faiths who believe in that spiritual, moral necessity of caring for others and caring for our world. And we are that much more effective. We are that much more strategic when we engage in that work together. And it's a spiritual exercise as well to open our hearts to others outside of our faith communities to accomplish that work.
On In Good Faith, we believe that all faith traditions have something to teach us about how God is working in the world and in our lives. So join us as we listen and learn and discover how speaking with people of other faiths can strengthen our own faith and even our own practice. We have an interesting conundrum in the United States, which is that the Constitution says there should not be the establishment of a state religion. And so we talk about, and we are even very proud of, being a secular nation where church and state are separate. But at the same time, that doesn't mean they can't work together, and there are so many examples where faith communities are the ones who best know the needs of the individuals in their group. So whether it's programs for literacy, providing food to hungry people, organizing social services, there are lots of ways that faith groups can do it best, but they don't always have the resources that the government has. So it is nice that while church and state can be separate, they can also each bring their strengths to bear in accomplishing good in cooperation. Today's guest, Maggie Siddiqui, has served as a senior advisor to the U.S. Secretary of Education on religious freedom issues. Previously, she served as senior director of the Religion and Faith Team at the Center for American Progress, where she led the organization's work on religious liberty and engaged a coalition of diverse faith leaders to advance progressive policies. She now serves as a senior fellow for the Interfaith Alliance. Since 2001, the Bush administration established the Office of Faith-Based and Community Partnerships, so they could see a need in government to partner with, not replace, but partner with religious organizations, community organizations. And there have been some version of that up through and including the administration you just served in. Why would a president or the executive branch invest in an organization like that? What did they hope would happen?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. Every administration, I think, envisions the role of those offices a little bit differently. But in essence, the idea is that faith-based and other community-based organizations are on the ground serving people every day. And if one of the critical roles of government is to ensure that services are reaching everyone, then it needs to partner with many different institutions, including those local institutions, to accomplish that great work. And in that process, government also needs to be really mindful of ways to uphold the free exercise of religion for all beneficiaries, to maintain the separation of church and state so that government partnerships with faith-based institutions aren't overstepping in religious matters. And so the role of those offices was really twofold, right? In facilitating those partnerships, that outreach, those connections, and in safeguarding those protections for religious freedom along the way.
You've had chances, I'm sure, to interact with people who were worried about religious freedom, whether it's being impinged upon or sometimes even misused. And I'm wondering, what gave you the most hope as you were serving this last administration in the office? What are some examples of people who kind of got it and were doing it right, quote unquote?
In 2023, we held a conference through my office, the Department of Education, on religious freedom and religious inclusion. And we invited K-12 teachers and university leaders and community leaders from across the country to speak about how they were not only upholding the basic protections of religious freedom for students of all faiths and none, but also what it looked like to support religious literacy and cultivate the value of religious pluralism and ensure that students of all backgrounds, religious and non-religious, could fully thrive and be fully free to learn as their full selves. And that was actually the name of the conference, Free to Learn. And that was a really beautiful gathering. And folks from different political perspectives, I think, were all really pleased by what they learned and what they took away from that conference. And so, like, that was an example of some of the work that we did where there was just this clear understanding of this is what it looks like for all students to feel included, and this is the work that government can help support in convening and addressing these common issues that we all share.
So people may say, well, we need to keep religion and school separate, except what you're talking about isn't really teaching or promoting a particular religion or even religion in general, but it sounds like to me it's having an understanding of the homes these students are coming from and what might be important to them. Does that sound right?
Yes. I mean, so first of all, yes, you know, religious literacy, I think, is incredibly important. I think, you know, for students to be able to learn about the different religions in the world, so not to engage in religious instruction per se in public schools, but to learn about religion and to learn about the diversity of religious and non-religious experiences in their school communities. Those are incredibly helpful things to have in any school, public or private. And, you know, ultimately what we were really talking about was the school climate and being able to fully bring your full self, including your religious self, if that was a part of your identity, into the classroom. And public schools are the only school system in the country that is required to fully uphold those constitutional protections for religious expression and prayer. The students can initiate prayer. They can engage in all kinds of religious exercise in public school, provided it's, you know, non-coercive and student-led. And I think that's something that many people don't realize. So my office, you know, updated the guidance around those constitutional protections during my time there and tried to get the word out about that so people understood that there were already some clear protections in place.
I'm just wondering now, because you're focusing with the Interfaith Alliance, obviously you see this as something that's important. Before you're doing sort of faith and government, faith and community, this is still community. And I've just seen so many good things accomplished when it's not just, well, I want to know the name of the pastor or the imam or the rabbi in my community, but that they actually meet, know each other, and then congregants actually work together. What do you really want to encourage with the Interfaith Alliance?
I love that question. So interfaith work has been, I think, a part of pretty much every one of the roles that I've had, including and especially perhaps when I was based at American Muslim Organizations. I've been, you know, deeply fascinated by the wisdom that we can glean from different faith traditions on a personal level. And then on a more professional level, perhaps I found such common cause with the work of joining together with people of different faiths who believe in that spiritual, moral necessity of caring for others and caring for our world. And we are that much more effective. We are that much more strategic when we engage in that work together. And, you know, it's a spiritual exercise as well to open our hearts to others outside of our faith communities to accomplish that work.
I've seen some really great examples of this from interviewing local interfaith leaders where I live, and they've really stuck with me. One example is a Salt Lake City rabbi who told me that to not recognize the divinity in another human being who was also created by God would be like blasphemy to him because there was something divine in them. And similarly, a local Mennonite pastor, Luke Miller, told me he respects everyone, that he has to because they are all God's children, whatever their specific beliefs. I'm wondering what you've seen that has eliminated fear and distrust between different religious communities. Or is that still aspirational? I can think of a few that I've seen, a few places that I've been able to talk to people where it's really made a difference in the tone of the community, not just knowing each other, but even standing up for each other, Jewish and Muslim and Christian congregations showing up for each other when there had been something bad happen in the world to say, we're here to protect you, we're glad you're here, those kind of things.
Yeah, I think we've seen a lot of powerful moments of that lately, of that need to stand in solidarity with one another. I think, sadly, right now, we're seeing a lot of misuse of, for example, of Jewish fears around anti-Semitism, the very real problem of anti-Semitism. And there's a sort of political exploitation that's happening of that fear right now and using it to target universities, sort of using the bias of Islamophobia to suggest that the problems of anti-Semitism are somehow coming from Muslim students. And so in the midst of that, of fears, misuse of our communities, there's been some really interesting steps in solidarity, really powerful statements that have been made from Jewish and Muslim and Arab Christian and other leaders of so many different kinds to say, no, we will stand in solidarity with one another. And we absolutely denounce any kind of fear or hatred that comes from within our communities and any fear or hatred that comes from outside of our communities against folks that we want to be in relationship with, and that we envision a pluralistic society and not a society that seeks to demonize each other. So I think there have been a lot of really powerful examples of that recently. But it does, you know, necessitate an ability to sort of be in real relationship with one another, to not take the bait of some of the divide and conquer tactics that are out there. And to say, no, I'm going to ask some more questions first. I'm going to, you know, maybe approach the person who's made a statement that I don't understand. I'm going to ask them why. I'm going to ask them to help me understand their perspective. That requires real courage.
Courage and curiosity above contention, it sounds like.
Yes. Yes.
So I'm going to go back and push a little harder for examples. I would just love to hear something concrete.
So there was a statement signed by, I don't even know how many Jewish community organizations nationally, denouncing anti-Semitism and denouncing the exploitation of anti-Semitism and saying that we refuse to be divided. For folks looking for it, it's on the Jewish Council for Public Affairs website. The Muslim Public Affairs Council that I'm now also working with as part of my efforts through Interfaith Alliance, issued at least a couple statements now denouncing anti-Semitism, committing to standing in solidarity with Jewish communities. They did this after the arson of Governor Shapiro's home of Pennsylvania during Passover, and they did this after the shooting of the two Israeli embassy staff outside of the Capitol Jewish Museum in D.C.
Right.
So those are some clear examples where it sounds small, but it goes a really long way, because there is this prevailing narrative that these are communities that aren't looking out for each other's interests. And I think the reality on the ground is very different. And so when national groups speak out in that way and commit to stay in solidarity with one another and to reflect that reality on the ground very publicly and in opposition to the sort of divide and conquer tactics out there, it really makes a difference.
It seems like you have to get to know somebody. Like you were saying, someone makes a statement you disagree with to go ask about it, in good faith, to coin a phrase.
Yes.
That takes a certain kind of courage that you mentioned. What do you suggest that people can do? I mean, there's waving to your neighbors. Is it that simple that if it's Ramadan, that we ask how the observation is going or something like that, just to have contact and to know each other?
Yes, I think that's a great example. There's that saying, right, that you don't talk about politics and religion, but if you can tell that religion is something that's important to your neighbor, I think asking them about it, or even, you know, after the shooting outside the Israeli embassy, I checked in with Jewish leaders that I knew about how they were doing, and I also checked in with Jewish neighbors with whom I'd never really discussed their religion, wasn't sure how important it was to them, but I said, if this is something that is really impacting you today, I just want you to know, thinking about you, and I'm committed to working together to make the world a better place and make the world a safer place for all of us. Like, I think that can go an incredibly long way. There are also so many different interfaith organizations out there. Shoulder to Shoulder is a really good example. Different groups, Interfaith America, my group, of course, Interfaith Alliance, that are all doing this work of building those cross-community relationships. And so there are ways to get even more involved in that kind of work as well.
That the connection to God, did you have that at a young age? Did that come later? Can I just ask a little bit about your personal journey?
I think I was a religion nerd even as a kid, so and deeply spiritual even then.
Join the club.
Yeah, I was that kid who always wanted to discuss religion during recess. And yeah, I was raised Baptist, came from a long line of Baptist clergy, as you can obviously tell from my Muslim appearance here. But yes, faith has been sort of a part of my story since childhood. I actually wanted to be baptized at a pretty early age. I was baptized at 11 and was very much involved in church. And it's funny because in some ways I feel like my conversion to Islam at the age of 18 was an incredibly Baptist move because, you know, Baptists believe in the sort of absolute liberty of conscience, right? And so when I felt my heart sort of called to the words of the Quran, felt that I had and that I could rather and should follow that calling. My father has joked occasionally that I am still very much a Baptist as a Muslim because of that absolute liberty of conscience in the Baptist tradition. And I certainly feel like I am continuing the legacy of the long line of Baptist clergy that I come from in the work that I do now.
How was that for your parents, if I could ask? It sounds like they were still keeping connection with you and maybe scratching their heads, but they knew—
That sounds right.
They knew you were still you.
That's right. Yeah, no, I think that they can very much see I'm still me and very much sort of in some ways on a continuation of the spiritual journey that they helped cultivate in me as a child. I'm sure they still don't fully understand the reasons around my conversion, but they're absolutely supportive and have always been, which I'm very blessed to have.
Well, I could name a bunch of things that I really respect and have some holy envy for from Islam. Are there one or two things that bring you the most joy or really about the tradition and the observance that help you feel connected to God?
Yeah, and I must say, I love this framing around joy. I don't know if you've seen that poem that's attributed to the poet Hafiz called Sometimes I Forget That I Was Created for Joy.
No, but I'm going to write it down.
I just love that. I love that way that you just asked that question. One thing I think is, so believers in Islam are referred to as those who believe in the unseen. And there's so much, right, that we believe that exists around us often as religious or spiritual people, right? We believe in God, angels, love, right? Things that we don't see with our own eyes, but we believe so deeply in that unseen world. And also that God sees what we do not. And there's a verse in the Quran that says, God has the keys to the unseen. He knows all that is in the land and the sea. Not a leaf falls without his knowledge. And so when I see a leaf fall outside, like that brings me joy. It's like this little sign from God just floating to the ground, a little reminder that God is seeing everything, caring for all of us, guiding all of us, including in all the ways we can't see.
That's beautiful. Now I'm going to think of that when I see the leaf. I already thought of it from New Testament when I see a sparrow. Not a sparrow falls without God's notice. But I remember a woman in my community came to me once after hearing a conversation with a Muslim woman in which she mentioned praying for her children. And the lady came to me sort of like, I can't believe how dense I was. She said, I somehow didn't know that they pray like we do. Like this woman was praying for her child. Well, of course she does. But I pray for my child. But until I heard her say that, it seemed like it was something different. And she just made that connection. And she said that gave her the courage, for instance, the next time she went into a retail store, she was buying some clothes. And she'd been, after 9/11, a little iffy if she saw someone, for instance, with a headscarf, the hijab. But she said she got the courage to go up to the cashier and just chat with her. And she said, the woman didn't know that that was a major step for me, but knowing what we had in common in our faiths made it so I could feel she was my friend. And I'm thinking of things like National Day of Prayer services and other opportunities where we hear people from multiple faiths share a prayer or chant part of a surah from the Quran or whatever it might be. Those things seem like they're so binding to us. We all say we're all children of God. We say those words, but I don't know how much we feel it when people dress differently or simple as use different spices in their food, something that might be new to us. Although if you try it, then you're like, how did I live my life without this? And so I love the type of work you're doing. I just wish we could figure out, as a society, how to get to know each other better and to actually feel what we say, that we're all children of God. So if you would just do that and solve the world's problems, I'd appreciate that.
It's actually a running joke in Interfaith Alliance right now because so much of my work is about healing some of the rifts that have come between our communities that they say, well, Maggie's going to solve this problem for us. So, but in seriousness, you know, it does take those kind of baby steps like the woman you described going up to the cashier who was a Muslim woman and talking to her. That I don't know if you've seen Ted Lasso, but that quote comes to mind sometimes, that all people are different people. I think that's something also to keep in mind in interfaith relationships.
Especially Ted is different.
Yeah, so he is different. But all people are different people, meaning sometimes the biggest divides between us are assumptions that we have ascribed to individual people in our midst based on the communities that they're a part of and what we perceive those communities to be standing for, rightly or wrongly. Like, there's a good chance those assumptions in and of themselves are wrong. But keeping in mind, all people are different people. And approaching our neighbors of different faiths the same way that we would a neighbor of our own faith, without assumptions about the perspectives that they hold, what they pray for, you know, how they feel about us. That requires a lot of internal work, actually, to recognize that we might be carrying those assumptions and to say, hey, all people are different people, and to go in openly into that relationship.
Okay, this is such a dinky example, but I have this thing that I cannot stand when I get into elevators with people and we all stand there and pretend we're all alone. We're all there. And I just can't help it, because maybe it's only in me, but there's this little tension about this is not human. And so usually I go in and it's simple as which floor, like, shall I press the button for you? Or just like, someone just came in from the rain. Like, whoop, looks like an umbrella day. I mean, those are the stupidest comments, but they are an interaction. And I see this little release of tension when someone says, oh, 14th floor. Or, oh yeah, should have brought my umbrella, but I was running through that. And then suddenly we're just people. And so I'm just thinking, whatever it might be, and we're with someone, I think we set each other at ease if we just reach out and say, hi, I'm human. I recognize you are too. And that can be as simple as, wow, where'd you get your daughter's shoes? Those are amazing, you know, or whatever it might be. Just the teeniest connection, it seems like, can just release tension.
Yeah. Or even a simple good morning or good afternoon.
Yeah. Why not?
Right?
Every religion says to do those things.
I think that's an incredibly powerful thing, right? Muslims, when they greet each other, they say, you know, in Arabic, peace be upon you. It's a very powerful statement, actually. It means, you know, I'm here to give you peace, to do you no harm.
Yeah.
And that example of being in the elevator of, hey, I'm a human being, it makes the world a little bit less scary. I think that's really powerful.
If I meet someone who is Muslim, is it appropriate for me to know how to say and to say, is it ma salama? Or how do you say it? Salam alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum. It's a little complicated. Alaykum. Sometimes you can just say salam. Salam means peace. It's a simpler, shorter version. Well, but yes.
Good morning is fine, maybe.
Good morning is probably also fine.
You've had to make a conscious choice to adopt a different dress than you grew up with, and that makes you also very visible. Do you feel tension from that? Or do you feel like, well, this is a conversation starter? Or all of the above?
So I should say I didn't wear the headscarf immediately after converting. It was probably 6 years or so later.
And as I understand, it's not required. It's a choice. Or does it depend on the
tradition?
Yes, I
don't believe it's required. There are some Muslims who believe it's absolutely required. Some believe it's not. There's a kind of diversity of opinion there. And I think the reasons for wearing it are very different from one another. For some Muslim women, I know that being visibly Muslim is a big part of why they wear it. For me, that is not part of it. And so I don't love sort of being so immediately identifiable all the time as a Muslim. For me, it's more of a spiritual practice that many religions share, right? Sort of covering the top of your head.
Right.
That's almost hard for me to put into words. But yeah, I mean, it does mean that how I engage in public, I realize that I may be received differently from people who don't understand. And I hope that when I engage kindly with people in public, that hopefully I am shattering any misconceptions that they might have. And I hope that I'm making it a bit easier for the next Muslim that they meet, that they might be a little bit more open to engaging with that person because of their positive experience with me. And so, yes, there's kind of an extra burden in how I go about the world for that reason. But yeah, I hope that it is one that is ultimately helpful in healing any divides.
Thanks to Maggie Siddiqui for speaking with me. You can learn more about her work at interfaithalliance.org. Be sure you subscribe to the In Good Faith newsletter. Go to ingoodfaithpodcast.org to sign up for behind-the-scenes access. This episode was produced by Heather Bigley. Our production team also includes Aaliyah Alexander, Heidi Hansen, and James Sturtevant. Our post-production sound designers are Mark Hansen and DJ Cromarty. In Good Faith is committed to the idea that we all benefit from hearing people of widely varying backgrounds share their personal experience with faith and belief. In fact, we think people with such experience deserve some of our best listening. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at In Good Faith Podcast. Also, subscribe to our YouTube channel for extended interviews. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. Join me again soon, right here, In Good Faith. If you're like me, you want to stay informed, even about some of the tough topics that have to be discussed, but so much of the discussion just really doesn't move anything forward or generate light as much as heat. That's where Top of Mind comes in, a BYU original podcast. They understand how polarizing those kind of conversations can be, and they want to help us engage in that challenge while actually learning something. Their goal is developing empathy for others. Top of Mind can help you clarify your own views, become an effective advocate for the things you care about, and even challenge your way of thinking so you can become a better citizen, a kinder neighbor. Listen to Top of Mind now on the BYU Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.